system to simulate an operation that you might not be able to do. So the standard example in quantum information theory is the restriction of local operations in classical communication. So if we don't have a 1,000 log, don't have a quantum channel, then all they can do is local operations in classical communication. And the kinds of questions people want to answer are, if you give me one sort of entangled state, can you transform it into a different sort of entangled state? And how does an entangled state substitute for a quantum channel? So in particular teleportation, if you have a maximum entangled state, you can essentially use that to simulate one use of a quantum channel under the OCC operations. So there's the whole body of entanglement theory, think of it as the resource theory for the restriction of OCC. What I'm going to talk about is the resource theory for a different kind of restriction, which is when you don't have a classical reference frame in the background for some degree of freedom. So in particular, I want to talk about the kinds of manipulations you can do on resource states, and I want to talk about measuring how good a quantum reference frame is. So just as you have measures of entanglement, you have measures of frames. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And then finally, the work I've done with GLI, we consider three sorts of reference frames, three sorts of restrictions. So there's the case where you lack a Cartesian reference frame, so there's a reference frame for directions in space, or a reference frame for phase, or a reference frame merely for chirality. And so there's different groups associated with those, and in a sense they're different strengths of restriction. And what you find in entanglement theory is that the LOCC restriction has different strengths depending on how many parties there are. So in general, LOCC is a weaker restriction for two parties than it is for three parties. And so for instance, with three parties, you can never transform a GHZ state to a W state. They're both entangled three-part states. There's no way to go from a GHZ to a W, even with some probability less than one. And whereas for two parties, you can go with some probability from one state to another, or vice versa. For four parties, you find instead of just two classes of states, or one class of state, you actually have an infinite number of classes of states. And so the amount of interconversion you can do tends to go down as the number of parties increases. And what you find in the reference frame situation is that as the strength of the restriction increases, so as the number of operations you can do goes down, and so essentially, as I go from a chirality, lacking a chirality reference frame, to lacking a phase reference, to lacking a Cartesian frame, that gives me fewer and fewer operations, and I find I can do fewer and fewer manipulations. Right, so let me get into it. So if I write down, say, a state of a spin half particle, such as spinning up along the n axis, I'm essentially assuming a reference frame in the background. So I'm assuming that in the background there's some Cartesian frame that defines the direction n hat. And so there will always be some physical system that defines that frame. It's not just a choice of coordinate system. There could be, for instance, some gyroscopes in my lab that define what z up and x up and y up are. Could be the gravitational field of the Earth. But there's some physical system that defines it. And if you didn't have access to that system, just to some system that could define directions in space, you would be restricted to preparing quantum states that were rotationally invariant, because you have no way to prepare something that was pointing up along any direction. And so the lack of a Cartesian frame implies rotationally invariant states are the only ones that you can prepare. Mathematically, that corresponds to density operators rho, which are invariant under rotations, where this is a unitary representation of the rotation group, which I'll write like that. So this is the angular momentum operators as a vector. This is an encoding of the three Euler angles. So this is just a rotation of the density operator. And if I lack, for instance, a phase reference, that I get phase invariant states. So again, I'll have some unitary representation of group U1 now. So yeah, up here the rotations are the group SO3, but if I want to include spinners, maybe SU2. Down here for phase shifts, the phase shift is drawn from the group U1. This is the unitary representation of a phase shift on an electromagnetic field mode. So this n hat is the number operator for the excitations in that mode. And if I don't have a phase reference, then the only density operators I can compare are things that are invariant in this sense.
So in the first case, it's just the identity operator, something proportional to the identity?
Well, if it was a spin-half particle, yes. But if it was, for instance, two spin-half particles, then the singlet state is invariant under rotations. If it's three spin-half particles, then you have a whole two-dimensional subspace invariant under rotations.
Oh, I see. So these rotations are elements of SU2, but we can have many systems.
That's right. The Hilbert space for rho could be three spin halves and one spin particle, one particle, and it can be anything you want. Yes?
I mean, is this provably so that if you have only a rotation invariant means that you cannot prepare something that breaks a rotation invariant? So let's consider a classical example. I have a wooden stick.
Yeah.
And just let it fall.
Yeah.
So, if I put it approximately vertical, that's a symmetric situation, but sort of little variances will break that symmetry, and I could collect when sticks pointing in this direction, in this direction, and so forth.
Well, So you're saying you prepare a quantum state of that stick that was
not... No. It's a classical example.
Okay.
But I thought, there didn't seem to be something particularly quantum to the example that you gave, so I was just trying to...
I think the idea is that you prepare a state, and then you forget what direction you prepared it, right? So now you have to integrate over all, directions in space or something, right?
That's one way in which you could lack a reference frame. So okay. I think perhaps the problem here is that reference frames for orientation in space are everywhere. Almost anything can serve as a reference frame for orientation in space. This chair is just fine. It can define a z, x, and y axis. And so it's very difficult to imagine what it would be like not to have a reference frame for orientation in space. So let me give you a better way of motivating the restriction. Suppose
no, it's fine. You don't need to do that. I'm perfectly fine with the motivation.
Well, I'll need to do it eventually anyway. Okay, so I may as well. let me draw it here. So another way in which, there's two important ways in which you could lack a reference frame. One is that you just haven't built anything that breaks the requisite symmetry. So a good example of that would be something like the reference frame for the phase conjugate to charge. So just as with number of photons, there's a conjugate quantity of phase. I can talk about number of charges, say in a superconductor. There's a conjugate quantity of charge phase for that. And essentially, until you've built a superconductor, you have nothing that's classical enough to actually act as a classical reference frame. And so you just have no way of preparing anything that's in a coherent superposition of two different charge states. So that's one way you can have a superselection rule. Because we are presented with all sorts of things that are essentially good reference frame for orientation, that's not a good way to motivate this restriction here. But a good way to motivate that one is the following. Suppose that your interest in describing systems relative to Bob's Cartesian reference plane. So he has some local gyroscopes that he's using. And here's Alice's local gyroscope. And it may be that they don't know the correlation between them. And so what happens is that Bob if Bob sends over a system prepared in state row relative to his frame, then it's going to be re-described relative to Alice's frame by some transform version of row. So I'm not sure if people can see this spot here, but suppose there's some rotation that connects Alice's frame to Bob's frame. Then relative to Alice's frame, she re-describes that same state as the rotated version of Bob's description. And if she doesn't know what omega is, she has to then integrate. This is what Steve was saying. You have to then integrate with uniform measure over all the possibilities for what the rotation would be. And this state, by Schur's lemma, is rotation invariant. It's the average over all possible rotations of row. But does that answer your question?
No, it doesn't, but I can also optimize. It's not so important.
Okay. Nonetheless, I would say, in response to what you asked, that here is certainly one scenario wherein I think it's correct to say that the only states that can be prepared are the invariant ones, in the following sense. The only states Alice can prepare relative to Bob's frame, right? So her task is to prepare a state which encodes her predictions about what's going to happen to measurements done relative to Bob's frame. What states can she prepare? How much can she predict about his measurements? The answer is she can only make predictions that are consistent with these invariant states.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Do you also consider when the two observers are also at constant speed compared to each other? So you have to consider predictions.
So that would be an instance wherein, for instance, they would have a Lorentz frame. So you could imagine that they don't know what the relative velocities are. So one prepares a system, and then you ask, well, how's it described with respect to the other? So that'd be a different kind of restriction, which would be described by the Lorentz group rather than SU2 or U1. And I'm not going to consider that kind of restriction here, but everything I say could be attempted in the context of that. In general, these are just a few examples, but in general, a reference frame is associated with some group, so I'll just denote that group by G, and some unitary representation of the group on the Hilbert space, which I'll denote by T. B of H is the bounded operators on the Hilbert space.
You're assuming it's a Gira, too, or?
No. That depends on what system you're looking at. So, for instance, the representation of SU2 on two spin and a half particles is a reducible representation. And then the constraint on the kinds of states I can prepare are just those that are invariant under all possible transformations of the group.
You mean the absence of a reference frame?
Yes. So the lack of a reference frame for G. G implies that these guys are the only preparable states. That's actually this mathematical restriction is often referred to as a superselection rule. When you work out what sort of form of row you have, in particular if your group is abelian, like here, you find that row has to be block diagonal. And that sounds like a superselection rule where you're only allowed to compare density operators that are block diagonal relative to some structure. But in fact, people talk about non-abelian superselection rules, and the restriction of this sort of invariance is precisely equivalent to the restriction of a non-abelian superselection rule. So it's a bit more intricate. You have, you can have multiple blocks for the same irreducible representation. Anyway, so I won't go into the details of that, but The important thing is that this restriction I'm imagining, the lack of a classical reference frame, mathematically corresponds to a superselection rule. And so I'm going to interchangeably call this restriction superselection rule or a lack of a reference frame, because they're the same thing. And if it's associated with group G, I'll just say that lack of reference frame for G is equivalent to a G superselection rule. So it's an SU2 superselection rule, U1 superselection rule. That just specifies which group you have to average over. Now, traditionally, people have only characterized, you know, what happens to the quantum states. And then typically they also assume that the Hamiltonian should be similarly invariant under the action of the group. But from a quantum information perspective, what you want to know is what are the set of all operations, including non-unitary operations, that you can do consistent with the superselection rule. So let me tell you about that. So it turns out the answer, which I'll put the answer over here, I guess, is that the only implementable operations under GSSR, G superselection rule, are completely positive maps, which I'll denote by script E, which are invariant under a super operator action of the group. So script T is going to denote a representation of the group in terms of super operators. This has to be true for all G belonging to group G, where this super operator representation of the group is defined as follows. So it acts on an operator X just as follows. So this T is the appropriate unitary representation that is associated with that reference frame for group G. So this is, you know, plausible at first sight. It basically says if you can do an operation, the only kinds of operations you can do without having a classical reference frame for the group are those for which it wouldn't matter if somebody first transformed the system by G and then transformed it by the inverse. Because it, you know, it doesn't matter whether the thing's pointing up relative to the reference frame or not. The operation you're doing doesn't appeal to the reference frame at all. So that's maybe gives you a bit of an intuition why this is true. But let me give you a better motivation for it in terms of this picture here, where the reference frame in question is actually held by Bob, and Alice doesn't know the correlation between her frame and Bob's. So let's make this general and just say that there's some group element, little g, part of the big group g, connecting Alice's frame to Bob's. So Bob would send a system over to Alice, and she would re-describe it now as follows. Integrate over the group, the harm measure. This is the sort of state you have. But now suppose that instead of just wanting to re-describe the state, what's going to happen is that Alice is going to do some operation, script E, on the system, and it's send it back to Bob. And the question is, how's Bob going to describe that system relative to his frame after Alice has done this operation? So this is an operation defined relative to Alice's frame. So the first thing you need to do is transform a row so that it's now described relative to Alice's frame. So that's just this. Then you implement your operation. And now it gets sent back to Bob. So to find out what it looks like relative to Bob's frame, I have to do the inverse transformation, like so. And because you don't know what group element it is, you have to integrate over the whole group. But now this is just my script T. And so this becomes integral over G of script T of G of E composed. Actually, I got this backwards. These should be daggers here, and dagger here, and dagger there. So this is how an operation E relative to Alice's frame gets re-described as an operation relative to Bob's frame. And so it follows that the only operations that Alice can hope to achieve relative to Bob's frame are those that aren't changed by this twirling operation here. So they're the E's that satisfy this equation. And it turns out that it's not hard to show that this implies this condition here. So E has to be invariant under the action of every element of the group. So is that clear or not?
Why the inverse G is the same as the, this operation I have used? Why the inverse operation is similar to the, this operation? The G.
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
The question is, why is it the same G on the first and second T?
Oh, I see. Because in one situation, so there's a fixed group element G that relates Alice's frame to Bob's. So the first question I'm asking is, if I want to re-describe something which is rho relative to Bob's frame, I want to re-describe it relative to Alice's frame, what do? I just apply, so G is going to be how Bob is related to Alice. So to describe something from Alice's perspective relative to Bob, it's G inverse. Maybe it's best to write it like this. In this direction is the element G, and going this way is the element G inverse. It's just, Bob might be rotated by 3 degrees relative to Alice. That means Alice is rotated by -3 degrees relative to Bob. So as I re-describe things going this way, I have T of G inverse, T dagger of G inverse, which is just the same as T dagger of G. But then after we've applied the operation, and now we say, how do I describe the result relative to Bob's frame, I have to do the inverse transformation to get back Bob. That's good.
Is this a sum? So Alice is different to Bob's frame with respect to this star measure.
Yes.
Is there some deeper reason for that, other than it's the one that mathematically can make this kind of sentence?
Well, you could imagine that she, suppose it wasn't the R measure, then I would say there is some correlation between their frames in that case. I mean, then it would have to be peaked somewhere. And that would mean, for instance, that Alice says that, the Z-up Bob is most likely to be oriented along her end axis somewhere. And so that would be a situation where you could certainly consider that as a restriction. Mm-hmm. Suppose Alice only knows this much about Bob's frame. And you could use a whole resource theory for that case. It's just a lot more complicated. Actually, Matthias Christandel at Cambridge and I are working on figuring out how to characterize those kinds of restrictions by taking the distribution of the group, breaking it up into group characters and sort of having a nice decomposition of that. But this is the easiest to look at. Other questions? Okay, so this is really what we want to characterize. The super operators that are invariant in this sense for groups of interest. So in particular, we're looking at U1, SU2, and eventually also Z2. And so this is actually one of the hardest parts of the problem, because there's no simple way of characterizing this. But what Gilad and I discovered was that you can make a lot of progress by asking what the Krauss decomposition of this super operator has to look like. So, the Krauss decomposition for gene variant operations. Right. Okay, so every super operator we know can be associated with a set of Krauss operators, which I'll denote by K mu, which just means that the super operator is given by sum over mu, K mu, K mu back. And now it's well known that there are many Krauss decompositions for a given superoperator, and there's a unitary freedom. So I can do a unitary remixing of these Krauss operators and get the same superoperator. And so In particular, that means that the if I take this superoperator here, with its crash decomposition noted by L mu, or I can actually write it as L mu of G, because the superoperator is indexed by G. Recalling what the action of script T is, this action here, this is related to the K mu crash decomposition just by as follows. That step clear? Okay, but now I know by virtue of the assumption that this is invariant of the group that this superoperator and this superoperator are actually the same. And so that means that these two Krebs decompositions are Krebs decompositions for the very same superoperator. So there must be a unitary remixing of these Krebs operators that gives me those Krebs operators. And so that tells me that there exists a unitary matrix. So I'll call the unitary matrix little u. It's n by n, where n is just the number of indices in this Krebs decomposition. I have this relation here. So for those of you who may not know about this unitary remixing business, you can find that in the SN12, for example. So that's nice. It tells me a very strong constraint that the Krebs operators have to satisfy. But now you can use the group theoretic structure to make a lot of progress. So the first thing you can do, well, the first thing you know, is that you can always choose those Krebs operators to be linearly independent in the operator space. So let's do that. And then let me just define a vector of these operators. So so K vector is just the vector whose components, so the mu-th component of the K vector is just what I was calling K mu. And then if I take this unitary matrix acting on that vector, I get this vector of possibilities. So let me just denote that as follows. And then if I multiply this through by the inverse transformation, I get this. Like so, and then if I, and these two guys cancel. Excuse me. Okay. Right. Good. And then this implies because the K vectors are a set of linearly independent operators, they form a basis for the whole space. So this implies that UG, inverse UG, is just the identity matrix. I should tell you where I'm going with this little calculation. What I'm now going to show is that this unitary matrix here is a representation of the group. And so that's what makes this really nice, is that you're going to find that T of G is a unitary representation of group on the Hilbert space. This U of G is going to be a unitary representation of group on this n-dimensional vector space that I just defined here. And so the first step of that is to prove that U of G inverse is just U inverse of G. And that's what I've just done. Okay, so that's one thing that needed proving. And then you can also show that if I take G compose G prime, acting on K mu, this is what I get. So U prime. And I suppose I could have just asked you to take it for granted, but I'm going to prove it to you. I can rewrite this as G prime So I'm just rewriting this in my vector notation. Okay, and then if you plug in this expression here from both sides, you get u of g composed g prime k is u of g prime k. K is linearly independent, therefore u of g composed g prime is u of g prime. And that's the second property that I needed to show that u is a unitary representation of the group. Okay, so this is...
The u there is... So that's an operator k m or whatever that subscript is. Right,
the upper sum mu.
That's a mu prime there on the right. And so that's an operator, and that's an element of the matrix multiplying the operator. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So this is just an n by n matrix where n is the number of these operators.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so I'm just saying this is a unitary representation of the group on an n-dimensional vector space. Okay. So it's a real vector.
The improving is that first law, that second line, I guess.
Yes.
U of g inverse acting on k of g. Do I just regard that as a definition of k? I'm a little confused as to what exactly the chain of reasoning is you're using there.
So I define this k vector as
k.
And this I just, maybe I didn't define this carefully enough. It's just the vector of these guys.
Right.
Okay. So
you
g
multiply.
Is just the matrix.
Sure.
So I multiply by u g inverse.
Yeah.
And that gives me this. And now the reason I know that that's equal to k.
That's the question.
Is because then
unless you already know the associate there, the u of g, g prime is u g, u g prime or something, you can do that for us. But you need the second property.
Okay. That's a good point. I can't think of the logic at the moment.
If you did the second part first and then did the other one, then I would believe. I thought maybe you were using some other chain of reasoning there that I could not discern.
I think you're right. I mean, maybe that's a flaw in the logic.
Sorry?
That may be a flaw in my reasoning.
Well, I think I have to turn the board upside down.
Yeah. So forget this, use this, and then plug in the case for G' of the inverse. And you're all right.
Okay. Then I'm happy.
And you're happy. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Other questions?
But you gave a reason earlier that it's because the matrices in the vector K are linearly independent.
That's true. That gets me from here to here. But the question was, how did I get to this step? This was equal to K.
Yeah.
And I don't think I justified it properly. I think I have to start here to move up, as you said. All right, so one, and then two. Okay, so now that you have this, that's a very powerful tool for figuring out what that Kronsky composition is going to be. Because if this is a representation of a group, I can always write it as a sum of irreducible representations. And so suppose I introduce the unitary matrix on the n-dimensional vector space that diagonalizes it, or block diagonalizes this, into irreducible representations. Or should I do this over here? Yes. Yeah, things will get less technical shortly. This is the only really technical bit. So suppose W is the unitary matrix that takes U of G block diagonal form. Then, starting from this relation here, which is really just a vector notation for this here, I can diagonalize this guy. Just by acting with W on the left over here. And so that means that there's some other vector, I'll just call it k prime of g, because this w is just going to reshuffle the components here. And now some diagonal matrix, u prime of g, in prime, like so. And so now, let me just do this diagrammatically. This U prime thing is block diagonal, so I'm going to draw on a bunch of blocks, just as an example. It looks something like this. The blocks could be of different dimensionalities. And I mean, this could be a non-abelian group, so there might be arbitrary many different irreps. So I'll call the different, I'll label the different irreps by j's. So I could have, j1, j2, j3. And then a basis for each irrep will be labeled by m values. So I got m1, m2, and so on. And then each one of these irreps could have multiplicity. So here I have the same irrep twice, and I'll introduce alpha as a multiplicity index. So alpha 1, alpha 2, for example. And so I can write, I can label the elements of this vector as k, j, m, alpha. And this one here, that's just k, j, m, alpha of g. And now, I go back to my original notation, what this means is that there exists a Krauss decomposition wherein the Krauss operators are labeled by the irrep, a basis for the irrep, and a multiplicity index, such that those Krauss operators look like this U. There we go. Right. So the key is that the only things that get mixed up are Krauss operators that have a given J and alpha. So the only mixing occurs within a particular irrep and a particular multiplicity index. And so as long as I know what the irreducible representations of the group look like, I can start to figure out what the Krauss operators for any invariant superoperator have to look like, because they have to satisfy this constraint. I'll show you in the case of an abelian group exactly what the form of those Krauss operators are, because it's relatively straightforward to work out. But in the case of non-abelian groups, this is actually quite a complicated constraint. But people have actually studied this in nuclear and high-energy physics. So let me point out that if I write this as a superoperator equation, so script T of G acting on these K, J, M, alpha operators, they're just sum over M prime, so I'm just rewriting this equation. It's analogous to what happens to the angular momentum eigenstates. So suppose the group now is SU2. So J is the angular momentum quantum number. So J times J plus 1 are the eigenvalues of J squared. M are the eigenvalues of J plus Z. Alpha is a multiplicity index. If I rewrite this equation, I know that when I rotate one of these eigenstates, I just get a sum of eigenstates with different m values. And the weights are given by the representation of the group. So this is just how I remix eigenstates to get a rotated version of the eigenstate. And so this relationship I've just written down is the analog on the operator space of this relation on the Hilbert space. So it turns out these sets of Krauss operators, k, j, m, alpha, for different values of m, with j and alpha fixed, are called irreducible tensor operators. And these are the things that have been studied in nuclear physics and characterized. And as far as I know, this is the first application in quantum information theory of this stuff. But anyways, it's quite powerful, the tools they've developed. In particular for SU2, the Wigner-Eckert theorem, which I had completely forgotten its content, but just remembered the name until Matthias Brissandel at Cambridge pointed out to me that he thought the Wigner-Eckert theorem answered the question of what these things look like. And sure enough, if you look it up, you find the Wigner-Eckert theorem tells you if you have a set of operators that are irreducible, form an irreducible tensor operator, so they satisfy that relation, then they have to have a very particular form. Their m, j, and alpha dependence is very restricted. In particular, their m dependence is very restricted. And the theorem tells you exactly what form they have to take.
So, yes. I'm just a little bit confused, because I guess I would have thought that you would have started working with the ERFs to start with, right?
So,
what is it in K that makes it reducible? This ultimately comes from this definition of G invariant operators. So, in some sense, suppose I have two different J's there, right? Then if I go backwards, that's going to percolate into some E, but ultimately that E itself is reducible, is it not, in a certain sense?
Yes.
So why not work with the irreducible thing to start with, is my question. I'm trying to understand what it means to work with the reducible one.
Let me work at the level of the Hilbert space, right? So if I give you an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space, you can always write it in terms of these Engelmann eigenspaces.
Yeah.
And in a sense, you're writing it as a coherent superposition of these things that are labeled by the ERFs, the basis of the ERF and the multiplicity index. And in a sense, what I'm doing is I'm saying a superoperator, an invariant superoperator, can be given a very particular decomposition where its Krauss operators are labeled in exactly the same way.
Sort of reminiscent of a Clebsch-Gordon in some sense, except you're not combining things.
Well, the Wigner-Eckert theorem basically tells you that these Krauss operators are a particular sum of things with Clebsch-Gordon coefficients. So in a sense, all I'm really doing is coming up with a very convenient decomposition of the G invariant superoperators. Because if I just tell you, look, the operator satisfies that relation up there, the superoperator satisfies this relation, well, that doesn't really help you, write down, what all the possible superoperators are. But if I tell you, okay, you can consider a superoperator that has any Krauss decomposition whose Krauss operators satisfy this form, and then it turns out you can figure out explicitly what all the superoperators are. And I'll do that for the U1 case. There may be a different path to my destination, and if so, please point it out, especially if it's a simpler path. Let me mention in that regard that Jean-Christian Boileau and Lana Sheridan, Martin Afforet, and Stephen Bartlett have written a paper characterizing the SU2 invariant operations, and they do it in a completely different way. They don't talk about the Krauss decomposition. They show that it's an exponentiation of a certain kind of math, and JC's talking about that on Wednesday. I don't really understand the connection between their characterization of the SU2 invariant superoperators and our characterization. But I do know that this helps us get us where we want to go. So maybe I'll show you where we're going, and it'll make a bit more sense. More questions? Okay, now we can start doing stuff with this. So the kind of question I want to answer is, if I'm lacking a reference frame, and you give me a state that's non-invariant under the action of the group, well, what can you do with it? What can you transform it into? So on. So let me consider the case of the U1 superselection rule, because it's to some extent the easiest. Resource theory for the U1 superselection rule. So remember that the unitary representation is just of this form, where n hat is the number operator. So I'm imagining I have some multimode, say, state-of-the-art magnetic field I'm imagining phase shifts on that system. This is how I represent those phase shifts. And then, I mean, there's other contexts in which I can imagine a U1 superselection rule applying. For example, if you and I share an axis, a z-axis, but we don't share an x-axis, then what we're lacking is the phase of my x-axis to your x-axis. So that would also be described by a U1 superselection rule. But I'm going to focus, and that would just be a change of notation ultimately, that instead of the number operator here, I would have j sub z. But all the mathematics would be the same. So let me just, for concreteness, focus on this example. So if I ask, what are the U1 invariant states? Well, the answer is just the ones for which u5 row, I'm going to write it out, it's just the ui(n) row minus ui(n) row. And those are just the ones that commute with the number operator. So the density operators that are diagonal in the total number eigenstate bases. Now, here comes the interesting question. What about the U1 invariant operations? All right, well, we apply this result over here. I know I can apply any operation, these Krauss operators are like this, where these guys are irreducible representations of U1 now. So U1 is has only one-dimensional irreducible representation, so that means that we can drop the m-index, because it only runs over one possibility. So the m-index is gone, and instead of calling the irref j, I'm going to label them by k, and it's any integer, positive or negative. So we have irrefs labeled by k belonging to the integers, and the kth irref is just e to the I k phi. And so if I plug this into that expression, this is what I get, that the Krauss operators are labeled by k, the irref, and some multiplicity index alpha. And if I transform the Krauss operator, then it just takes this form. I just pull out a phase factor in front. And so if I write down an arbitrary expression for that Krauss operator, in terms of the number eigenstate basis, so these n vectors are just number eigenstates on the space. And I plug that into this equation. On the left-hand side, I just pull out a phase factor, e to the I phi n minus n prime. And on the left-hand side, I just have this same thing over again, but with a phase factor e to the I phi phi. And therefore, I get that n prime is equal to n minus k. And so that tells me that the arbitrary form of this Krauss operator is just a sum over a single index. And it takes n minus k to n. All right, so I can interpret this now, I can decompose this in a convenient way. I'll write it like this, sk k tilde, where the k tilde is now just going to change the relative amplitudes of different number eigenstates. So it just has these components. And the s is a shift operator that just increases the number by k. And so overall, what this Krauss operator does is it changes the amplitudes in your state in any way you like, and then it can shift the state rigidly. Every number eigenstate can be shifted upwards or downwards by some fixed k. And that's what the most general form of the Krauss operator for one of these univariant operations is. And so now, immediately, you can start seeing what kinds of transformations are allowed. So suppose I ask about the following transformation. Say 1 plus 2 to 0 plus 1. So remember, these are number eigenstates. And these things are non-invariant under phase shifts. Right? The 1 state by itself is an invariant state, 2 by itself. But this coherent superposition is obviously non-invariant. So this is a resource state. This is something you couldn't prepare yourself, given that you don't have a phase reference. And similarly, 0 plus 1 is a state you can't prepare yourself. So they're both resources. They're like two different entangled states relative to the LOCC restriction. You can't prepare them yourself, and you want to know, can you do that transformation? So what's the answer? I've told you what all the superoperators look like. Any ideas?
Yes, you can do it.
Yes, you can do it. That's right.
Stop it.
You want to do a shift operation. All right, so you just need to choose k to be minus 1, and you can shift the number rigidly downwards by 1, and so you can do this transformation. So this sort of resource can be transformed into that sort of resource. And more importantly, it doesn't actually matter what the phases here are, because these Krauss operators allow you to adjust the phases in any way you like, because this is completely free. And so the only thing that's actually really important here is what the weights are, not the phases. So suppose I write the initial state as sum over n pn n, root pn, and the final state as sum over n root qn n, then this is a drawing of the weights pn, this is a drawing of the weights qn, and all I need to notice is that I can do this shift operation to see that that's possible. Okay, so let me give you another example. What about something that's a uniform weight over 0 to 3, and the question is whether that can be shifted down to this 0 plus 1 state. So these are the PNs and QNs.
Well, don't you have complete control over those Cs?
You have complete control, yep.
Then, yeah.
And
you kill that other stuff. And
right, exactly.
Shrink the others.
So you can
raise the phase.
Yeah, you can find a superoperator whose Krauss operators have 0 on, say, 2 and 3, and just 1 on the 0 and 1 terms. And that superoperator will leave you, and no shift at all, that will leave you at the right state. You can find another superoperator which has zeros on the 0, 1, n equals 0, n equals 1 term, non-zero on the other two, and then shift that down by 2. And another way to say that is you just do a measurement here, whether it's 0, 1, or 2, 3. When that measurement's done, if you get this outcome, you shift it down by 2. And then you've done the transformation. And both those, that measurement, which distinguishes these two, is allowed because it's of this form. Here. Okay, one more example. Suppose you have this. So probability is a quarter, quarter and a half, and you're trying to shift it down to this standard state that we're considering. Any guesses on this one? It's not obvious. You do a measurement, which is a POBM measurement, that has two outcomes. So E0 is the first element of the POBM. It has the form 0, 0, it's a half, 1, 1. And the second element of the POBM is a half, 1, 1, plus 2, 2. And these if I take the root of these guys to be my cross operators, then they have this form. So it's a measurement I can do in a phase invariant way. And if I get the first outcome, then I squeeze this guy down by half, and so I'm left with this state. If I get the second outcome, I just get the 1-2 state, which I have to shift down by 1 to get this guy. And so you can do the transformation. So you can then ask, well, what's the most general case in which you can do the transformation? And you find the following theorem, that the transformation is possible if and only if the vector of weights for the initial state, so P vectors, the vectors, components, or the Pn's, is a convex combination, so WKs are just a probability distribution, of shifted versions of the Q vector. So this epsilon K is going to just represent shifts by K of these weights, rigid shifts. That's it. So I'm not going to prove that for you, but I sort of, you know, if you think about these examples, right? So in this example, the Q is this distribution. It can be obtained as a convex combination of shifts. P can be obtained as a convex combination of shifts, namely the trivial combination of just shifting by here. This guy can be obtained as 1/2 don't shift to 1/2 shift by 2. This guy is probability 1/2 don't shift, probability 1/2 shift by 1, and so on. So this sort of just gives you plausibility for that. I think this is a nice result because it reminds you of the result we get in entanglement theory, the same question. So if you ask entanglement theory, when is there a deterministic transformation between some entangled state psi and some other entangled state phi, the answer is if the spectrum of the reduced density operator of the initial state is majorized by the spectrum of the reduced density operator of the final state. But if you look at this, and you think of this as a whole operation, it's a convex sum of shifts. Shifts are a kind of permutation. Any convex sum of permutations is a doubly stochastic matrix. And therefore, if this is true, then P is majorized by Q. And so you have a same sort of result that you get in entanglement theory. The difference is that if P is majorized by Q, it doesn't follow that it's majorized in a way that ensures that these are the right kinds of permutations. It might be majorized by Q using a convex sum of permutations that aren't all these shifts. And if that's true, then it doesn't follow that I can necessarily do this transformation. So this is a stronger constraint than majorization. It implies majorization, but isn't implied by it.
So do you have the characterization of that in terms of inequalities like?
Yeah, well, that would be great. You know, we have this other characterization of majorization in terms of sums and inequalities. And my open question, which I'm hoping I'll come across somebody who knows the answer to this, is whether the mathematicians have worked on this other notion, which is convex sums of shift operations, and whether they have characterizations of that. I wouldn't be surprised to find that somewhere in the mathematical literature people have looked at this, and it's sort of a sub-branch of majorization theory. If not, it's certainly an interesting thing to look at. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Maybe this is just obvious, but I can't think of the answer right now. So SL or LOCC is not, well, is that a group? Right?
Good question.
I mean,
yeah.
So it seems that, you know,
right. Can you
where's the unifying framework?
Yeah.
You're doing this all with groups.
Yes, right.
But it doesn't seem to include entanglements.
That's true. So what's the unifying framework?
I mean, it's just
yeah.
channels.
No. Here's my answer to that question. I mean, there may be many unifying frameworks. But if you look at a paper that came out from the guys at Los Alamos, so Burnham, Viola,
mm-hmm.
Ortiz.
Generalized entanglement.
Yeah. That Ron
yeah.
Soma called the generalized entanglement.
Yeah.
What they try to do is characterize restrictions by they want to characterize generalized entangled states in terms of a preferred set of observables. So for instance, in my language, the preferred set of observables could be things that commute with a number operator. And then what they would call generalized entangled states relative to that set of observables, I call resource states. So what they say is generalized entanglement, I say is a resource. And I think that's a better terminology for what they're describing anyhow, because entanglement implies that we have two systems. But nothing they do requires that there be two systems. It's not necessarily a question of correlation. It's a question of overcoming a restriction. The preferred set of observables sort of defines a restriction, and having coherence between them is overcoming that restriction. And so they've characterized the non-invariant states, my non-invariant states, in this more general framework. And then they can also characterize the LOCC restriction in terms of the preferred observables being local observables. So that's a nice overarching framework for the two sorts of approaches. Okay. The problem is that they haven't got a good characterization of the analog of LOCC. So they characterize the states that are resource-like and the states that are free. But they haven't characterized what the operations that are free are. And that's sort of what I did over here with this theorem. So there's a really nice project remaining to be done, which is to generalize everything they've done and characterize the operations.
Nobody has a good characterization of OCC. That's the big problem we're contending with.
True. But they don't even have a candidate. They don't even have an abstract characterization of what the allowed operations are, because they weren't really coming at it from a, here's a physical restriction, let's see how to represent it mathematically, which is what I did. The physical restriction is you don't have a reference frame. How do we represent it mathematically? They instead sort of came from a mathematical approach and said, well, let's find states that are generalized entangled. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have a natural way of talking about the operations. But my guess is that you could first try to characterize my restriction in their language, and then maybe it would be clear what at least an abstract characterization of all restrictions would be in their language.
So then, are there monotones relative to these?
Yes. Good question. Okay, so, I kind of breezed over that. Actually, I didn't say anything about it, but, this is something you can certainly do. I have a page on that.
It seems like a von Neumann entropy on a reduced state would be kind of the natural thing to try.
There are no reduced states in this approach.
Well, but you can, well... Yeah, okay, I see.
So let me say a couple of words about monotones. So just as you have entanglement monotones, which are attempts to measure entanglement, they're functions over states that are non-increasing under LOCC operations. And I should say the motivation for monotones is that typically when you're trying to measure something, you're trying to measure it, come up with an operational measure. So you should quantify what you can do. And so if you're ever faced with a certain task and you want to know what's the maximum probability, for instance, with which I can do this task, or what's the maximum number of states of a particular sort I can get at, that the definition of that task already involves an optimization. And so if your task involves an optimization over all possible operations, then it shouldn't be possible to do better by first pre-processing your resource. Because the definition of the task assumes that all the pre-processing has already been done. So it better be the case that the definition of your measure of the resource is such that under the restricted operations, the measure doesn't increase. So for entanglement monotones, you just say it's not increasing under LOCC. Here you want functions f that are not increasing under gene invariant operations. I'll say a bit about this when we come across one. So let me say just a few more things about the T1 case. So far, I asked the question up here about deterministic single copy transformations. I demanded that the final state be obtained with probability 1. But you can also ask about stochastic single copy transformation, where you just want to know can you go from psi to phi with some probability? In the context of entanglement theory, the answer to that question is given by Vidal's theorem. And so what I'm about to tell you is essentially the analog of Vidal's theorem for these the resource theory under the U1 superselection rule. Right. So, first of all, you notice from the form of the cross operators that you can always change the not just the phases, but the weights of any of these number operators. And if you're looking at stochastic transformations, then you know, whatever the weights in your final state are, you can always sort of adjust the weights in your initial state to correspond to the weights you're looking for. So the weights are something you shouldn't worry about. It's only whether they're zero or non-zero that's really your concern. So instead of characterizing states by the PNs, all you really need to do is look at the number spectrum of the state, which is just the set of n values such that PN is non-zero. That's the only thing that's relevant for the question of stochastic transformations. So let me consider a particular example to make this definite. Suppose I have a state which has non-zero weight, I don't know, say, here, on zero photons, one photon, 5, 6, 7, and 10. And I want to know, is it possible, with some probability, to get to the state which has a non-zero weight for, say, these three guys, 3, 8, and 10. So any, you know, take a state with any weights here, take another state with any non-zero weights here, is this transformation possible with some probability? The answer is yes, it is. And here's how you do it. You send this guy to zero. That's something you can do by choosing these weights appropriately. You can always send something that has non-zero weight to zero weight by making this coefficient zero. So you send that guy to zero, you send this guy to zero, and you send this guy to zero, and then you shift the whole thing forward by 3. And that's, again, something you can do because you're allowed these arbitrary shift operations. And so that sort of transformation is allowed. And now, you'd want a theorem that would give you the necessary and sufficient conditions for a stochastic transformation. And that's what Vidal's theorem does, and we don't have that. So there's an open question there. We do know, it's not the, we do know, actually, the necessary and sufficient condition for this. It's that stochastic transformations are possible if and only if the number spectrum of your target state is included within the number spectrum of your initial state shifted by some amount. So this plus k is just going to denote, take all the n in the spectrum and shift them by k. So if and only if there exists a k belonging to the integer such that this is true. Is not the analog of Vidal's theorem. Vidal's theorem then asks, if this transformation is, well, in the context of entanglement theory, if the transformation is possible, what's the maximum probability with which it can be achieved? And that's the thing to which we don't have the full answer. All we can say is that if it so happens that there's only a single value of k, such that this condition is satisfied, then the probability of psi going to phi is just the minimum over n of pn over qn plus k. If any of you know Vidal's theorem, that looks vaguely reminiscent. But anyways, there's more work to be done here, and I suspect that the techniques that Vidal used to solve this problem can also be applied here. I want to kind of wrap up. Let me maybe just say one more kind of question you can answer, and then I'll move on to more general questions. So suppose you now ask about asymptotic transformations. So this is the question that people are, I think, most interested in the context of entanglement theory. It basically says, if I have some state psi, and I allow you to have an arbitrary number of copies of it, and how many copies of some state phi can you turn it into, approximately? So the limit that n goes large, and you want to get to some state which has fidelity close to 1 of this target. You can ask the same question here. You say, well, psi is now some resource state. It's one of these coherent superpositions of number eigen states. Phi is some other resource state. How many copies can you get? So actually, you can solve this question completely. You know that you can always write an arbitrary state in the standard form, where you've shifted the phases to just all be zero, some weights. And then I exponentiate this. And it turns out that you can characterize the result fairly simply. These are n's. I won't write down expressions, but you use a big multinomial expression. And as long as all the pn's are non-zero in this range, you'll find that these r's go to a Gaussian. And that's the key. This thing goes to a Gaussian. So whatever psi was, as long as these things are all non-zero, and whatever phi is, as long as all of its weights are non-zero in its range, then both of them, when exponentiated, become Gaussians. And I know that two Gaussians are, well, I know I can shift the total number, so I can shift them so that their means coincide, but I can't change the variances. So the condition that has to apply for this transformation to be possible is that the variance of psi tensor n has to equal the variance of phi tensor m. But what you can prove is that the variance is actually additive. So this is just n times the variance of psi, and this is just n times the variance of phi, and therefore the rate at which this transformation can be achieved, so the ratio m over n as n goes to infinity, is just v of psi over v of phi. And so what it means is that if phi, for instance, this one function, the variance, if I tell you the function over all the states, the variance of all the states, then that one function is enough to tell you the rate at which you can convert any state into any other state. And so it's like the entropy of entanglement. It's a single function that tells you everything about asymptotic convertibility. And so so it also is a monotone, a Fermi's monotone. It's not increasing under these invariant operations. And so it's quite nice. It provides a nice example where this rate turns out not to be an entropy at all. This isn't an entropic quantity.
Is that a sufficient condition?
Relative to the assumptions I stated, which was that for all n in this range of 0 to d, pn is not equal to 0. So we call this gapless number spectrum. So if the number spectrum of your initial and final states are both gapless, then this is the necessary. This is the answer. The variance tells you that the transformation is reversible, and the variance tells you the rate. But the open question that still remains is, what about states that don't have gaps in their spectrum? And so there's some sort of rich structure here. So we know things like, if you take 0 plus 1 tensor n and 0 plus 2 tensor m, this guy will have a Gaussian profile, but he'll have no amplitude for any odd number, because you'll never, by exponentiating this, you'll never get an odd number. And so this one you can't get from here to here. There's one way you can and the other way you can't. I think you can get from here to here, but you can't get from here to here. So you don't have reversible transformations between these two states. There's a whole host of open questions that remain if you look at states that have different kinds of number spectrum. I guess the main point of all this is just to show that, in a sense, well, the lesson I draw from all this is that what we ought to be interested in are resource theories. Every time you have a restriction, you get a resource theory, and you get all this interesting structure and these interesting questions to answer. And typically in quantum information, people are very focused on entanglement theory, and somehow there's a notion that the most truth about foundations of quantum mechanics will come from studying entanglement to death. And we'll get more and more esoteric questions about entanglement theory, and they're all somehow worthwhile to study. And my sense is that this sort of work and other papers like this provide a bit of an antidote to that notion that, you know, there are very simple kinds of restrictions you can imagine that are equally foundational or not foundational. But the LOCC restriction, in my mind, is not a foundational one. It's a practical one. We happen to live in a world where quantum channels are harder to build than classical channels. That's where the LOCC restriction comes from. It just says classical channels are cheaper. Therefore, relative to our current technology, the resource of entangled state is the valuable one. In the future, when quantum channels are cheap, maybe we won't care about entanglement. Similarly here, if you don't have a reference frame, then you care about these resource states. They're valuable to you. And so you want to know how you can manipulate them. And there's a whole theory that develops. And it seems to me it's interesting. You learn a lot by answering these sorts of questions. And I'm sort of interested in knowing, I'm more interested in other contexts, what the answers to these questions are in other contexts. So you can obviously generalize this to lots of other groups. I've only told you about U1. We've done it entirely for the Z2 group, which corresponds to lacking a reference frame for chirality. So you know, Alice and Bob both have Cartesian frames, and the only thing they don't know is whether their two reference frames have the same handedness or not. Turns out that resource theory is really nice. It's even cleaner than entanglement theory. You know, for every pair of states, you can always get from one to the other or back with some non-zero probability, and you get a really nice measure of the asymptotic rate. And anyways, it's a really nice theory. And then if you go to the SU2 case, you get a really ugly theory. I mean, you use the Wigner-Eckert theorem, and you can make a little bit of progress, but it's kind of nasty. And so we have limited results there. But I suspect that eventually it could all be worked out. Anyways, but I'm more interested in sort of going further than that and looking at other kinds of restrictions. So people, for instance, have looked at non-Gaussian states under the restriction that you can only do Gaussian operations, for instance, in linear optics. That's, I think, a very interesting, possibly has practical applications for quantum computing. People have also looked at these non-local boxes, and they've said, suppose you can only do non-signaling operations, but I give you one of these non-local boxes. How can that be used as a resource? That's interesting. But the thing that I'm really keen to look at is thermodynamics. So it seems to me that it ought to be possible to characterize thermodynamics, quantum statistical mechanics, as a resource theory. There's supposing you don't have a high temperature heat bath and a low temperature heat bath at your disposal, but I give you a couple of quantum states that are sort of like baby heat baths, you know, finite versions of these guys, much like these quantum states are baby versions of classical reference frames. How much work can you extract from those quantum states? Can you convert them into various different forms? What is temperature in that sort of picture? Can you have an interpretation of all the usual concepts of thermodynamics in terms of resource theory language? Maybe that's going to turn out to be a stupid idea. I don't know. But it looks promising to me. So yeah, let me stop there for questions. Yeah.
In the case of entanglement, even though you can't prepare an entangled state using Locke, you can still verify that you have an entangled state using Locke by, for example, violating Bell's inequalities. Mm-hmm. How does that pan out in this type of situation?
Good question. Mm-hmm.
Well, don't you almost get it by definition? If somebody hands you a special state that you can't prepare, and you can perform the task.
Yeah, well, what's the task? How do you decide what task?
One of these tasks, you know.
You have to decide what, well, you have to verify that you got that state saved rather than.
I mean, you may not be able to, I mean, it may have something to do with the fact that these are group theoretic restrictions as opposed to LOCC, which, as far as I can see, is a connected thing.
See, in a sense, you, with the Bellian properties, you sort of have something that goes up to the two parties, and there's some classical information that comes together at a point.
Right.
And I sort of can imagine if I was allowed to sort of send things back to you. So you send me a state. Maybe it's a coherent superposition of a number of eigenstates. Maybe it's not. It's either a resource state or not. And then I think, well, if it is a resource state, then I can rotate its phase by pi, send it back to you, and when you do a measurement, you'll get the opposite outcome from what you would have gotten if I'd done the identity transformation. But I don't think that's sort of a much weaker thing than violating Bell inequality. So I'm not sure it's really an answer to your question.
But maybe a different way, a different, a related question is, in what sense is it a resource? What is it?
Well,
or maybe you can provide a possibility, that's one reason.
Right. So that was, I'm thinking, actually, maybe violating Bell inequalities is not quite the same characterization of entanglement as something that you can't prepare by LSEC. So there's sort of two aspects to a resource, and there's two ways of defining entanglement. Entanglement sometimes is defined as something that's non-separable, can't be prepared by LSEC. And other times is defined as something that can be used to do some interesting tasks, like teleportation or so on. In the context of mixed states, those two definitions don't coincide. So we all of a sudden have to, change our language and say, well, there's two notions of entanglement here. And so, in a sense, maybe what we need to do here is define a different notion of resource. So there's just, being able to be prepared by invariant operations. But then there's also things like, can you use this to simulate an operation? So that would be like, can you use an entangled state to do teleportation, simulate a quantum channel? We can ask the same question here. And in general, the answer is yes. Right? If I give you one of these 0 plus 1 states, you can actually use that to do something that typically would have required you to have a phase reference, like measure the phase of something that's coming. So I can give you this thing, and you can use it to mock up a measurement of phase. It'll be a noisy measurement of phase, but you can mock it up.
That's a good answer. So
you'll be able to measure phase with these sorts of resources better than if you didn't have the resource.
Yeah.
But isn't it possible that the other ways of doing it just as cheaply as it were? I mean, what I'm trying to understand that sort of intuitively here is, in the case of a chirality, ignorance.
Yep.
And when you can provide a state that's a resource with respect to that ignorance.
Yes.
But is that going to be the easiest way of getting the resource? I mean, why not? What would happen if you just looked at the two reference frames or something? I mean, in the case of entanglement, you're stuck with the local operations and classical channels and so on, and you're saying, I don't want to pay anything more. And then you're given the state, and it's by definition a resource. But
so I think the answer to your question is yes, there's a much easier way of overcoming the restriction, which is just get yourself a reference frame. It's like getting yourself a quantum channel. If you want to be, I'm done with the whole entanglement stuff. Let's just build a quantum channel. Okay, done. Let's forget about entanglement. We don't need it anymore. We've got a quantum channel. It's like you and I are in the same place now. And similarly, if I could just acquire a reference frame for the degree of freedom, I'm interested in a classical reference frame. And then I don't need any of this. But in many contexts, it might happen that the best I can do is send you 100 spins that represent what's up for me, and that's all you've got. And then you've got to make the best that you can. And in a sense, we know that quantum theory is right, and classical theory is not, and so the assumption that our reference frame is external and perfect is one that you can question. You can always say, well, suppose I wanted to take that reference frame and actually quantize it, treat it as a quantum degree of freedom. If you do that, then you have nothing left to define up anymore. And so all the operations you can do after you've quantized your reference frame are invariant operations. And so in a sense, this is a bit like, when you take measurement devices and you treat them quantum mechanically and you ask, how do I re-describe everything? But I'm doing that for reference frames. I'm saying, if you want to quantize all your reference frames, and this is actually something that Stephen Bartlett and Terry Rudolph and I have been working on for several years in various other contexts, what happens when you quantize your reference frames. But previously, we didn't have a good characterization of what the invariant operations look like. So the key really was this result involving the Kraski proposition. That's what allowed us to do all this work that I told you about today.
I don't know how to characterize this kind of thing. You just discussed being able to not necessarily have a reference frame. but at the same time, you are adopting a kind of operationalist, not necessarily philosophy, but a paradigm for this work, because you have the observer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not characterized quantum
mechanics. That's true.
So in the case of certain reference frames, that may not make a lot of sense. For example, you know, spatial
yes.
reference frames. What kind of observer do you have in mind that doesn't have a notion of up or down?
Right. Yeah, to some extent, my own body serves as a Cartesian reference frame, so how could I ever really be without one? So I agree with that comment, but I think there is something interesting still, and so you could say the SU2 reference frame, the resource theory, is sort of not so interesting. But in fact, you could say, well, any given gyroscope or system only defines a Cartesian frame to a certain precision. If I want to have a really precise notion of you know, what angle in space I'm oriented along, I need a high-precision gyroscope. And so in a sense, you could just say, well, what's the resource theory of the SU2 reference frame, you know, at every significant digit? And so you might, you know, it's very easy to have a reference frame for orientation that's very imprecise. My body provides one. But if I want one that's, you know, 10 orders of magnitude better, then I might start having to use quantum systems to do it, and there have been many proposals that we could get better gyroscopes by using squeezing and squeeze states and quantum enhanced techniques. So that's where this sort of stuff will come into play. And I think Hideo's talk on Wednesday.
Might, well, depending on what the observer is, you might want to include some of the observer in your quantum system too.
Yeah, you could.
That's what it seems like it's calling for in some sense.
Which just as entanglement theory wasn't expressible within this framework, I'm not sure I can necessarily represent every measure device within this
yeah,
framework.
Is there another way? Maybe there's a more general notion.
Yeah, so I think this algebraic approach.
It's not just an external agent conducting standard measurement type operations on the system.
Not exactly following. Well, what I thought you were saying was, can you use this sort of framework to quantize any measurement apparatus and then, you know, re-describe the whole experiment with that measurement apparatus quantized?
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is no. And this is for quantizing reference frames, things whose transformations are described by some group. And if you want a more general framework, I think you need a more general framework to describe any measurement device. And possibly the framework that I talked about earlier for generalized entanglement by the Los Alamos group might be sufficient, but I don't know.
Yeah,
Okay.